Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Katie Weaver tells us about one American woman taking legal action over her husband's death. Faith Perlow presents this week's Everyday Grammar Report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
An American woman is suing several companies in connection with her husband's COVID-19 infection and death. Patricia Woodward accused companies involved in the 2021 production of a television series of ignoring safety measures. The measures were designed to prevent the spread of the virus among workers. Woodward began the action in January at a federal court in Boston, Massachusetts. Her husband, Paul Woodward, worked as a passenger vehicle driver for the production group in the town of Provincetown, Massachusetts. He transported crew to and from their hotel to places where filming was to be done. He had tested negative when he began working on the project in February of 2021. He left the project to go to the hospital in mid-March after experiencing signs of COVID-19 infection. He died of COVID-19 on April 18th. He was 67. He passed away on the morning of our 25th anniversary, wife Patricia Woodward said in an interview with NBC 10 Boston, a local television station. So that day, instead of going out to dinner or having champagne, I had to go to the funeral home, she said. The lawsuit seeks damages for wrongful death, recklessness and gross negligence, pain and suffering, and loss. The companies did not immediately answer requests for comment. Patricia Woodward said that the filming in Provincetown happened before the widespread availability of COVID-19 vaccines and during a period of strong COVID-19 restrictions. During the filming, the production companies brought in hundreds of workers who stayed in hotels. The legal case noted that the defendants' COVID-19 measures were supposed to include exact and frequent testing, safe distancing, safe transport between filming sites and work areas, and the use of masks and protective equipment. The legal case also said crew, actors, contractors, and other employees openly flouted and violated the COVID-19 safety rules. And it said the companies failed to take the necessary corrective action about that situation. For example, legal documents in the case say that Paul Woodward was ordered to drive a vehicle that did not have a protective barrier in place. Barriers separate the driver from the passengers to prevent possible passage of the virus. The legal case said other vehicles used in the production did have protective barriers. In addition, the lawsuit noted there were also supposed to be safe distancing, occupancy limits, and masking requirements in the automobile, but that the rule was ignored by passengers and not enforced by the defendants. I'm Katie Weaver.
Have you ever read stories like Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, or The Frog Prince? These stories are called fairy tales. Although you might not have read them in English, you likely can find these magical stories in your own language and culture. Fairy tales are stories passed down through the generations. The names of the characters might be in a different language, but many of these stories seem to tell of similar events.
In today's Everyday Grammar, we will look at the beginnings of these stories and find out the when, who, and what of these stories we loved as children.
Many fairy tales in English start with the same opening. Once upon a time. When we read this phrase, we immediately know the story is a fairy tale and have ideas about what might happen. Many cultures have similar expressions beginning their fairy tales. We know that these stories are made up. We set aside our disbelief to enjoy the magic of these stories. Once upon a time answers the question of when. In English, the expression once upon a time means at some point in the past. It is used to talk about a story that happened a long time ago, but the exact time is not important.
Once upon a time, there lived an old woman. Once upon a time, there was a rich man who lived happily for a long time with his wife. From Cinderella.
Some fairy tales open with, "There once was a..." This phrase also shows that the story happened in the past. Both openings help us understand that the story is in the distant past, but they do not tell us about the characters in the story. Which brings us to our next question of who. In fairy tales, nouns identify important people, places, and things. But adjectives are also very important.
The adjective little can be used before a character's name, like Little Briar Rose in the Grimm Brothers version of Sleeping Beauty. Other characters might be described with two nouns together, like Snow White or the Snow Maiden.
There are several kinds of characters in a fairy tale. Sometimes the stories are about families. There are often siblings, brothers, and sisters. You might read about a husband and wife, or children and their parents.
In the story of Hansel and Gretel, the children are brother and sister, and they get lost in the forest.
Sometimes there are even step-parents or step-siblings. Family members created by a remarriage.
Cinderella has two stepsisters.
There is always a good character. This might be the hero or heroine, a female hero, in the story. This person carries out actions, like rescuing someone or helping others, or they might have a task to do, or solve a problem.
Jack is the hero after he climbs the beanstalk and kills the giant. Cinderella's fairy godmother acts as a heroine by helping Cinderella get ready for the ball.
There are villains or bad people in fairy tales that might harm or put a spell on the hero or other characters in the story.
Cinderella has an evil stepmother who makes her into her house servant.
There is often royalty, a queen or a king, in the stories, because during the time of these tales, that was how things were. And if there is royalty, there are also commoners, or everyday people, who might come from poor situations.
Rapunzel is a princess who is locked in a tower.
There also are magical numbers and objects found throughout fairy tales.
The most common magical numbers are 3 and 7. For example, there is the story of Goldilocks and the 3 bears. In the fairy tale of Snow White, there are 7 dwarves in the forest.
Sometimes words, phrases, or actions are repeated 3 times. We can also find magical objects in fairy tales. These can help the hero or heroine, like the glass shoes in Cinderella. They can also be used by the villain of the story, like a house with chicken legs in the story of Baba Yaga, or the evil queen's talking mirror in Snow White. And there are magical animals that can talk and have human-like traits in fairy tales. These animals can be either good or bad. They can help or hurt the main character. In some tales, they might be the main character.
The cat in Puss in Boots talks and wears boots.
Today, we talked about the beginning of fairy tales. We answered the question of when in the opening, Once Upon a Time. And we answered the questions of who and what by thinking about the different characters, magical numbers, and objects in a few stories.
Let's close with some homework. Choose a favorite fairy tale in English. Then, write down the answers to the following questions. How does the story begin? What opening sentence does the story use? When does the story take place? Who are the characters?
After that, describe a few characters. Are there any magical numbers or talking animals? Who is the hero? Is there a villain? Send your answers to Learning English at voanews.com. Share your work in the comments below. I'm Faith Perlow.
You just heard Faith Perlow present this week's Everyday Grammar Report. Faith joins me now to talk more about the lesson. Hi, Faith. Welcome back.
Hi, Ashley. Thanks for having me back on the show.
This week, you talked about fairy tales, the opening Once Upon a Time, and types of characters. You also gave the listeners some homework, asking them to share about their favorite fairy tale. So, Faith, what is your favorite fairy tale?
My favorite tale is a Slavic tale called The Little Snow Maiden. The story opens up with, "There once was an old man and woman."
Interesting. So our first two characters are an old couple. Who are the other characters?
So this is where the story gets very interesting. It is winter time, and the old couple really wanted a child. They see children playing in the snow. So they build a snow girl, and she comes to life. She has rosy cheeks and is very pale, like the snow.
That's also the magical element, right?
That's right, Ashley.
Is there a villain?
There is not so much a villain. And I'll save the ending for another time. But I'll give you a hint. Winter turns to spring. And what happens in the spring?
It warms up. And the snow melts?
Sadly, yes.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing, Faith. I hope to have you back on the program very soon.
Thanks for having me, Ashley.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Surrender finally came for General Robert E. Lee and the Confederacy he had served as a great soldier. It was mostly his military skill and intelligence that kept the South in the field so long. But even his extraordinary skill could not save the South from the industrial power of the North and its mighty armies, armies that were well-fed and well-equipped. Stuart Spencer and Leo Scully continue the story of the American Civil War.
The last chapter of the bitter four-year struggle came in April 1865. General Grant had pushed Lee's army away from Richmond and nearby Petersburg, Virginia. His Union forces had kept after the Confederates for almost a week. Lee fled westward across Virginia. His tired, hungry soldiers tried to turn south, to reach safety in the Carolinas. But always, the Union Army blocked the way. Finally, on Saturday, April 8th, Lee's army found it could flee no farther. A Union force at Appomattox Station blocked any further movement to the west. Early the next morning, Lee tried to break through the ring of Union soldiers that surrounded his army. But he failed. Nothing was left. Nothing but surrender.
Lee sent a note to General Grant, asking to meet with him to discuss surrender terms. A few hours later, General Grant rode into the crossroads village of Appomattox Courthouse. General Lee was waiting for him at the home of a man named Wilmer McLean. Lee rose as Grant walked into the house. Grant did not look like a great military leader, the chief of all Union armies. He was dressed simply. His clothes were the same as those worn by the lowest soldiers in his army. His boots and pants were covered with mud. His blue coat was dirty and wrinkled. But on its shoulders were the three gold stars of the Union's highest general.
Lee was dressed in his finest clothing. He wore a beautiful gray coat with a red sash tied around it. At his side, he carried an ivory and silver sword. The two generals greeted each other and shook hands. Grant said, "I met you once before, General Lee, while we were serving in Mexico. I have always remembered your appearance. I think I would have recognized you anywhere." Lee said, "Yes, I know I met you then, and I have often tried to remember how you looked, but I have never been able to remember a single feature."
Grant continued to talk of their service in the Mexican War. He said later that he did so because he was finding it difficult to bring up the question of surrender. Lee took part in the light talk for several minutes. Finally, he said, "I suppose, General Grant, that the purpose of our meeting is fully understood. I asked to see you to learn upon what terms you would receive the surrender of my army." Grant answered, "The terms I propose are those I offered in my earlier note to you. That is, the officers and men surrendered will not take up arms again, and all your weapons and supplies will become captured property."
Lee said those were the conditions he had expected. He asked Grant to put the terms in writing so he could sign them. "Very well," said Grant. "I will write them out." It took him several minutes to write the surrender agreement. Only once did he look up. He had just written the sentence, "The arms, artillery, and public property will be given over to the Union Army." Grant stopped writing and looked over at the sword the old general wore. He decided there was no need to hurt Lee's pride by taking away his sword. So he added, "This will not include the sidearms of the officers, nor their horses, or other private property. Each officer and man shall be allowed to return to his home. He will not be disturbed by United States authorities as long as he honors this agreement and obeys the laws where he lives."
Grant gave the paper to Lee. Lee read it slowly. When he finished, Grant asked if the Confederate general wished to propose any changes. Lee was silent for a moment. "There is one thing," he said. "The cavalrymen and artillerymen in our army own their own horses. I would like to understand if these men will be allowed to keep their horses." "You will find," Grant said, "that the terms as written do not allow it. Only the officers are permitted to take their private property." "You are correct," said Lee. "I see the terms do not allow it. That is clear."
Until now, Lee's face had shown no emotion. But for a moment, his self-control weakened. Grant could see how badly Lee wanted this. "Well," said Grant, "I did not know that any private soldiers owned their horses. But I think that this will be the last battle of the war. I sincerely hope so. I think that the surrender of this army will be followed soon by that of all the others. I take it that most of your soldiers are small farmers and will need the horses to put in a crop that will carry themselves and their families through the next winter. I will not change the terms as they are written, but I will tell my officers to let all the men who claim to own a horse or mule take the animals home with them to work their little farms.
Lee was pleased with this. He told Grant, "This will have the best possible effect upon the men. It will be very gratifying and will do much to help our people." While waiting for the surrender papers to be copied, Grant presented Lee to the other Union officers in the room. Lee had known some of them before the war. After a few minutes, Lee turned to Grant. He told him that his army held about 1,000 Union soldiers as war prisoners. He said that for the past few days, he had no food but cracked corn to give them. He said he had nothing to give his own men to eat. Grant called in his supply officer and ordered him to feed the Confederate army. He told him to send to Lee's army enough food for 25,000 men.
Finally, the surrender papers were ready. Grant and Lee signed them. Lee shook hands with Grant and walked out of the house. Lee got on his horse and rode slowly back to his army. As he entered Confederate lines, men began to cheer, but the cheering died when the soldiers saw the pain and sorrow in Lee's face. Tears filled the old man's eyes. He could not speak. Soldiers removed their hats and watched silently as Lee rode past. Many wept.
A crowd of soldiers waited at Lee's headquarters. They pushed close around him, trying to touch him, trying to shake his hand. Lee began to speak. "Boys, I have done the best I could for you. Go home now, and if you make as good citizens as you have soldiers, you will do well. I shall always be proud of you. Goodbye, and God bless you all." From the crowd came a loud cry. "Farewell, General Lee. I wish for your sake and mine that every damned Yankee on earth was sunk 10 miles in hell."
On the other side of the lines, Union soldiers began to celebrate. Artillerymen fired their guns to salute the victory over Lee. Grant heard the artillery booming and sent orders that it should stop. "The rebels are our countrymen again," he said. "We can best show our joy by refusing to celebrate their downfall."
General Grant left Appomattox Courthouse to return to his headquarters a few kilometers away. Suddenly, he stopped his horse. He had forgotten to tell President Lincoln or War Secretary Stanton that Lee had surrendered. He sat down at the side of the road and wrote a telegram to Secretary Stanton. News of the surrender reached Washington late on Sunday. Most citizens in the capital did not learn of it until early the next morning. Then, cannons began to boom out over the city. Crowds rushed to the White House to cheer the president. They asked Lincoln to make a victory speech. Lincoln said he had not prepared a statement. He wished to wait until the next night. He asked the people to come back then, and he would have something to say.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.